Good afternoon. So, last time, we started off by talking about reordering of loads and stores. So we mentioned we had this idea that hopefully our loads and stores were atomic, and that let us kind of reason about what would happen when we had multiple threads accessing the same things. We found out that, well, they're atomic, they happen all at once, or not at all. As far as observing them, we don't have an in-between state, but it turns out that processors and compilers don't do them in the order we write them in our program all the time. And to avoid this, for the processors, we needed special instructions, which have stronger rules about the processor knocking that off, not doing that reordering. And we need ways of telling the compiler, hey, don't do that. And for those special instructions, we have this idea of a memory fence, that there would be some special instruction which ensures that everything before it isn't reordered to after it, and everything after it isn't reordered to before it. So we have actual separation. And this would let us start to reason about what would our programs do. And we learned that things like pthreads has, you know, like create, join, lock, and so on, would all use those special instructions as appropriate and also tell the compiler, hey, there are other threads going on here. Don't do those silly tricks you were doing to load things earlier that will make my lock or my join or my create not have the results I would expect from things executing in order. So then we looked at, well, if processors can share data, how does that actually work? And the simplest model we have is that they're all connected to memory, and they all go to memory every time they need to read or write a value. But we know that that is not actually what happens, because that would be too slow. That we actually have caches on our processors, and typically one per core. And we want to cache a value on a core, even though another core might want to use that value. Now, the simplest way we could make this work and not have the cores get confused about what value is actually there would be to always send out the value whenever we write it. That's a valid approach, but that's typically too inefficient. It gets rid of a lot of the reason we have caches in the first place, is so we don't have to talk to memory and every single other core every time we do something. And every time we write isn't all the time, but it's most of the time, and that would be too much. So our idea was that we take advantage of all the cores and memory being put together, and we'd have this property we'd enforce that at most one core would be modifying a value at a time, and if a core was modifying a value, no other core would have a copy of it cached. And to enforce that, we'd have to tell the other cores when we were writing a value so they get rid of their copy. And we have to make sure that if another core wanted to read a value, we'd give them the modified copy. And we had a protocol where we tracked states for each cache block that ensured those properties would hold. And I mentioned that we had this protocol where we, you know, ensured that we had at most one modified version of each cache block. And I said cache block because the cache works in these block units, which are, turns out, larger than what we typically read or write from memory. And that makes sense because that's less bookkeeping, and we want to read and write a lot from memory anyways. But it creates this problem that I can have one core write a value in one part of the cache block and another core write a value in the other part of the cache block, and they have to take turns. Even though it's a different value, the caches only know about the whole block. And they assume if you're writing part of the cache block, you're changing the whole thing, even though that's not really true. And this means that we have bad performance because they'll be sending that value back and forth, even though for cases where it's different parts of the cache block, they could just work independently if only they had the bookkeeping to do that. And we called this problem false sharing. And the solution was, well, keep the values in separate cache blocks, even though usually we hope that we don't have to worry about what is a cache block. Now, after looking at cache coherency, we found, oh, there's something we can do with this that's going to help us with a problem we had earlier, which was implementing locks. We saw we technically could implement locks with atomic loads and stores, assuming they weren't reordered. We learned we could keep them from being reordered, but it was really annoying. And we'd like the processor to provide us something better. And the way cache coherency works, it's actually pretty easy for the processor to let us read and write a value that it has cached without any other processor getting in the way. And that's easy because to write the value, it needs to be the only one having the value anyways. So we can just read and write it while it's doing that. And this gave us read, modify, write atomic instructions. The main one we saw was atomic exchange. And I mentioned very briefly that there are others that processors can easily implement, like fetch and add, so read and also add to a value, or compare and swap, which is read and possibly write to a value. Whole bunch of them. We gave start with atomic exchange because it's probably the simplest and was enough to implement locks. Though there are these others which are easy to implement and more powerful, that, you know, if you wanted to have better locks or other types of synchronization. And I said atomic exchange was enough to implement locks, and the locks we implemented were these spin locks, where the idea was that we'd have a variable representing the lock, which would be a global in memory, and we'd have a value saying it's not taken or it's taken, and we use atomic exchange to set it to taken while reading its old value into a temporary. We'd look at that temporary and say, oh, was it already locked? If so, then I didn't change anything about it, and I didn't lock it. If it wasn't already locked, then I locked it, so I can move on. I've completed my lock operation. Okay, so questions about any of this before we move on and look at things that spin locks don't do? Okay, so spin locks, they're enough to get our synchronization, but there's a bunch of things that, you know, we're not going to like about them. So one of them is that we have locks. There are things we're going to want to do where locks just aren't going to be good enough, where locks are just the wrong tool for coordinating what threads are doing. So they're great for making sure threads don't interfere with each other, but there's other types of coordination that we've in fact already seen that locks are going to be a very poor fit for. Another issue with spin locks is, even though they implement the lock abstraction, they're kind of inefficient. That when we're waiting for a lock, if that's going to be a long time, we're going to waste a lot of CPU time. And what's worse is, let's say I have a single core and I use spin locks, or I have multiple cores, but the thing that has the lock isn't running right now, then I'm going to check, is the lock still taken? Is the lock still taken? Is the lock still taken? Over and over again, when I could be running the thing that's going to use the thing that the lock protects and then release the lock. Could be delaying the lock from being released in order to run the is the lock still taken code. Like to do better there. A third issue, which we won't talk about much, but is that spin locks, it turns out, are not the most efficient way of implementing locks in terms of atomic instructions, in terms of how efficient they are as far as messages sent between processes. There are more intelligent ways of using atomic operations that don't send as many messages and therefore are more efficient, with lots of cores especially. But we're going to start by talking about this first issue, that things the lock abstraction doesn't do. And I said, you've already seen some cases of this. Now, we haven't worked much with threads in particular, though you've seen one of the cases where locks aren't enough to implement something with threads. But you've seen this definitely more with processes, where you have a thread in one process and a thread in another process, which need to coordinate in some way. And the mechanisms we've seen so far, this locks aren't going to implement the type of coordination we've seen. So can someone give an example, maybe something that comes up in the shell assignment? There's some other cases, too, that you might think of where locks just don't provide the tool we want for getting two threads to coordinate with each other. Yeah?
If we want to wait for lots of threads to finish before we use
them. So if we want to wait for, you said lots of threads, so we'll talk about that special case. But even if I want to wait for one thread to finish, locks are actually don't work very well. Like, technically, I can do it. So I could do something where, like, I have a variable, is the thread finished? And I have a lock to make sure I don't get reordering or inconsistent views of that. But I'm going to check, is the thread finished? Unlock the lock. Check again, lock, is the thread finished? That's really silly and slow and inefficient. We want something which actually lets us wait for the thread to tell us it's done. Yeah, so that's the big thing. And we've seen this already, I said, with the shell assignment, wait PID. How do we implement that? We need something other than locks to do that sort of coordination. Another example we've seen is pipes. So in a pipe, the read needs to wait for the write to happen sometimes. And that's another case where locks aren't a good fit for that. Like, we can use a lock to check what's in the pipe's buffer, but we don't have an easy way of using a lock to say, don't do anything until there's something in the pipe's buffer. So we're going to talk about a whole bunch of extra synchronization primitives. And there's going to be, I have three written here, there should be four, that we're going to need to wait for things that locks just aren't good enough for. So I'm going to start by talking about barriers. And barriers and reader-writer locks are going to be cases that solve a particular pattern. So they're specialized to some particular programming pattern, and they solve a particular synchronization problem. We're also going to talk about condition variables, which we'll also call monitors, and counting semaphores. And these are going to be very generic. These are going to be powerful enough to implement pretty much anything you might want to do as far as coordinating between threads where locks aren't. So you can have one thread wait for another in all sorts of ways with condition variables and counting semaphores. With barriers and reader-writer locks, there's going to be one particular pattern that comes up a lot that they're going to be solving. I'm going to start with barriers. I'm going to start with barriers partly because they're pretty simple and partly because the life assignment, which is the next assignment, can be and is probably best done with them. You don't have to use them, but I would find it easiest and recommend. And these barriers are based around sort of parallel processing sort of needs. So when I introduced threads, I gave this idea of we want to have sum up an array between two threads, so we sum up half the array in one thread, half the array in the other. We wait for the threads to finish. Then we sum the values together. And for this waiting for all computations to finish, so far what we've used is pthread join. But pthread join waits for the thread to exit. That's kind of inefficient as far as if we wanted to do lots of sums, because we have to start a new set of threads each time, wait for them to finish. We'd instead like to start threads once and then do a bunch of these sums and have the threads go on to do other stuff. So we're going to want something that allows us to wait for them to finish. So we can do this operation without having to start a new set of threads every time. We just start them once and don't have to worry about how expensive pthread create is, which it's going to not be that cheap. Like, we have to allocate a new stack every time and make some system calls to make a process control block or thread control block. So it's not actually that fast. We'd like to just start them once. So barriers provide this interface. So there's an initialize operation, which takes a number of threads that we're dealing with. And there's a wait operation. And the idea is that we have a certain number of threads that are doing some tasks together, and they're all going to call this wait operation, and the wait operation's not going to return until all the other threads have also started waiting. So everyone syncs up together with this barrier operation. So the idea is that all the threads wait for the other to finish, and then they can move on to the next step. So we could use barriers to implement our partial sum idea, like so. So I have two threads, and I'm choosing arbitrarily that thread 0 is going to do the final summing. But thread 0 can't compute this final, I guess in this case, minimum, until we get thread 1's result. And if we had two threads, we couldn't do it until we had thread 1 and thread 2 and thread 3's result. We can extend this to more threads. That's the attraction of the barrier abstraction. And so what we do is we call barrier.wait here in both threads. And even if thread 0 finishes earlier, it's going to wait until thread 1 is done. And if there were three threads, it would wait until thread 1 and 2 were done, and so on. And thread 1 will also wait until thread 0 is done, though that doesn't come up in this scenario. So in this way, we know that when we read partial mins 1 here, we're getting an up-to-date version of the value, not something which hasn't been quite computed yet. So questions about what you see here? Now, this example isn't especially interesting because it doesn't look much more powerful than what we were doing by joining threads. But the power in barriers is that they're going to be reusable. So a very common thing which comes up in especially like scientific computing and simulations is that we want to run multiple steps of a computation where we've split up the data among multiple threads. So for example, if I'm figuring out what the weather is, I'll divide up, the Earth into little spots, assign each spot to a thread, and first I'll compute what happens in the weather from 1201 to 1202, and then I'll have a second step where I use the information about what was happening at 1202 to compute what happens from 1202 to 1203, and so on. So that type of simulation is really common, and it's also the sort of simulation you're going to have in the life assignment, that we have simulation where we give you code where we have this grid and we have a single thread that computes the next state of the grid from the previous state, and you're going to want to make that faster by using multiple threads. Assuming we have multiple cores, should be faster. So barriers with this look like this. So here I have results where the way my results 2D array works is that it's results time and place. So each thread is assigned a particular place to compute information for, and we advance time from 0 to 1 to 2. And for example, to compute the result at time 1, we need all the results at time 0. So in a weather simulation, it's like to compute the weather here, I need to know what the weather is 10 miles that way. So we get that information, and to make sure that it's safe to use results 0 of 0, even though it was computed in another thread, we need to make sure we don't use it until after it's computed, and the barrier does that because we're waiting for thread 0 to finish. And the same thing is going to be true in thread 0. It's going to wait for result 01 to be computed with its barrier wait. And we can use this multiple times. And each time we call wait, we have another round of everyone needs to wait before we move on. And barriers provide this interface without us needing to do anything to like make a new barrier each time. We just make a barrier once and just use it every single time over and over again. So in this case, we compute results 1 of 0, and the barrier means that we can use that in time 2 correctly with the second wait. So questions about how barriers work. So pthread has barriers, which is probably what you'll use in the assignment. There's an init function, follows the pattern you've seen so far, and a wait function. Okay, so any other questions about barriers? So let's go on to our second issue. So spin locks, we learned, wasted a lot of CPU time. And the main problem was that when we're checking if the spin lock is still taken, other things can't run. And what we really want to do is we really want to say, I can't do anything with the CPU right now. Hey, scheduler, run something else. So we're going to talk about a way of implementing locks where we integrate with the scheduler. Now, you might say, if we're doing this, why do we bother talking about spin locks? Like, clearly, we don't actually want to use spin locks. We want to use these locks most of the time, at least from applications. Maybe in the kernel, it's different. It turns out we're going to implement these locks using spin locks. So spin locks are going to be sort of a low-level tool to implement these better locks. And I'll show you that in a second. But the locks we want, and I'll call them mutexes because POSIX mutexes are a lock of this type, are going to, instead of running an infinite loop, they're going to give away the CPU. So when we lock, we want to go to sleep, assuming the lock's already taken, and add ourselves to a list of waiting threads. So this means the lock needs to store this list. And the unlock is going to need to wake up a waiting thread from that list. Questions about what we're trying to do. Okay, so to implement this, we need a list of threads that are waiting for the lock. And we need some way of making sure when we add something to this list, we aren't confused about what's on the list, that we don't have two things write to the same element of an array and interfere with each other. And to make that happen, we're going to use a spin lock. So we're going to have a list, and to make sure when we manipulate the list of threads, no one gets confused about what's on the list, we're going to use a spin lock to make sure only one thread manipulates that list at a time. But because we only have the spin lock to make sure the list is being changed in a sane way, we only hold the spin lock for a very short period of time. So if we're locking, we're going to hold the spin lock just long enough to add ourselves to the list. We're not going to hold it the whole time we're waiting. If we're unlocking, we're going to grab the spin lock to read the list, and then we're going to get unlock the spin lock. We don't need it anymore. So the spin lock, you know, it's not that lock corresponds to spin lock lock. We just use it to make sure we don't get confused about the list the lock and unlock need to manipulate. Okay. So questions about this idea before I show some pseudocode? So here's what our lock implementation, mutex implementation, might look like. So I said we had the spin lock, which I've called a guard spin lock. And what we're going to do is we're going to say we have these two variables to track the state of the lock. So one is a Boolean saying, is the lock currently taken or not? And another is what I called wait queue, which is just going to be the list of threads that are waiting on the lock, that if we unlock the lock, should get to use it. And this spin lock, what we will say, is protects it. So we're going to follow a convention that we're never going to touch lock taken or wait queue unless we've locked the spin lock. And when we're done changing lock taken and or wait queue, we're going to unlock the spin lock. And this lock taken variable is just going to say, is the lock currently taken by some thread? And this is going to let us know, do I need to even start waiting? If it's not taken, I don't. And this wait queue is a list of threads that are waiting. And every thread on this queue better not be runnable, because it was put to sleep. And the idea is when we unlock the lock, we're going to look at this and say, hey, does someone else want the lock right now? And make sure they get to run. So what this looks like in code, start with our lock operation. So first, we lock the spin lock, because I said we never touch lock taken or wait queue without the spin lock. And once we lock it, we first check, is the lock already taken? And if it's not, we have the easy case. We just mark it as taken, unlock the spin lock. So we use a spin lock. While we're doing this, we know no one else is also taking it right away, right now. So we're the one who got it. If not, we have to start waiting. And we want to wait not by checking the lock over and over again, but by telling the scheduler, hey, run something else now. So to arrange that to happen, we add ourselves to the wait queue. So later on, we hopefully run again. If we don't do that, no one else would know how to make us start running. We mark ourselves as not runnable. We unlock the spin lock and run the scheduler. So questions? Okay. Now on the unlock side, we're going to have to look at the wait queue. And remember I said we always use the spin lock when we're manipulating either the lock taken flag or the wait queue. So we're going to lock the spin lock. And we're going to check if the wait queue is not empty. And the easy case is it is empty. In that case, we just mark the lock as not taken and finish. Now, if it isn't empty, then we take a thread off the wait queue and make it runnable. Don't have to run it right away. We just need to make sure it runs eventually. So we can keep going. You know, we just need to know that it, when the scheduler gets around to it, it's going to run that thread. Now, something you may notice is missing here is that we don't set lock taken to false. And that's deliberate. What you should think of this as is that we're handing the lock off to the thread we just started made runnable. So the lock is still taken, but now it's taken by the thread we just made runnable. It's not running right away, but it has the lock now. And if we were explicitly tracking like which thread had the lock, we'd say now it's owned by a different thread. In this case, we aren't. But it's still taken because the thread we made runnable will start here. It's not going to change the lock taken flag. It's just going to run, assuming it has the lock. Questions about this lock implementation? So there's one subtle thing in here, and that's this part of the code. So here we unlock the spin lock and run the scheduler. And there's actually a problem with the code I have written here. And the problem is, what happens if the lock gets unlocked in between these two lines? And is that not obvious why that's really a problem? Because it seems like it gets unlocked, then we run the scheduler while we're runnable. That's something we can do. But we have to remember we have multiple cores. So a situation which could happen might be something like this. So here, thread A has the lock, or is trying to get the lock, and is about to wait for the lock. And thread B has the lock, and it's running, doing its thing. And we have this really unlucky scenario where thread B unlocks the lock right in between these two lines here. So this is where, like, right here, right before the scheduler gets run, it unlocks the lock. And at that point, it can unlock the lock because it can start accessing the wait queue because the spin lock was released. And it can dequeue thread A and set thread A runnable. And so far, nothing's wrong. So thread A is still runnable and it calls the scheduler. That's not a problem. The scheduler will figure out to run thread A eventually. But the problem is, then somewhere else, the scheduler could get run, and it could switch to A before A runs the scheduler. And when it switches to A, it's going to restore the registers of A. The question is, what registers is it going to restore? Well, it's going to store the last ones that thread A saved, which was a while ago. Because remember, thread A's, you know, the real registers are on the CPU, so it has some old version in memory. And that's real bad. Now, having this old version of the registers, two copies of the thread running at the same time when there should only be one at a time, that's real bad. So we need to keep that from happening. So some extra work and extra coordination with the scheduler needs to happen. And this means that when you're implementing a lock like this, you really need to have some cooperation from the scheduler. So in Xv6, the way we avoid this scenario is that we hold the scheduler lock while we're not runnable until we run the scheduler. Remember, when we switch to the scheduler, we have that lock. And if we were doing this in Xv6, we'd have the scheduler lock through this entire process from when we set it not runnable till we run the scheduler, which means that this running of the scheduler wouldn't be possible. It would wait until we release the lock and would get the right version of our registers. A different solution that is possible is that Linux doesn't have a scheduler lock like this, but it has separate tracking for is thread A still on a CPU from is thread A runnable to handle scenarios like this. There's a couple other things you could imagine doing to solve this, but you need to deal with this, and any solution is going to involve making sure the scheduler is watching out for cases like this in some sort of way. So questions about this scenario? So I mentioned, so we have these mutexes, and we needed some help from the scheduler. It needs to be integrated in some way with the scheduler to work correctly, but it gets us our no hogging the CPU while we're waiting. Another thing that's nice about this mutex design I've shown you is that when we don't have to wait, which we hope is the common case, like we hope most of the time that two threads just don't interfere with each other, they don't need to wait on the same thing, because if that's the case, then we're going to get the most value out of multiple cores, right? If the threads have to wait for each other, then we might as well use a single core, if that happens all the time. But if they don't, then hopefully they're mostly independent. And we call that the uncontended case, where no one's waiting for each other. And the uncontended case for this mutex is pretty good. It's acquire and release a spin lock to lock instead of Boolean, and require and release a spin lock to unlock and set a Boolean and check the queue. So that's pretty fast. And most notably, it doesn't involve any system calls. So as long as we don't have to wait for anyone, we don't need to ask, go into kernel mode, we don't need to disable our registers, and it can be pretty fast. It's not as fast as just using a spin lock, because like we're doing two spin locks instead of one, but it's pretty fast in that uncontended case, which is often what we care about, because like we hope our fast programs that use multiple cores usually don't have two threads that are stepping on each other. Okay. So questions about uncontended versus contended case? Okay. And as I mentioned, pthreads mutexes are implemented something like this. The details are probably a bit different. And we have our API for using pthread mutexes. So I'm going to mention a few little features of pthread mutexes so you know about them. So there's an attribute field for pthread mutexes. And some of those attributes might be useful at some point. So one of them that might be useful is that there's a thing called error checking mutexes. So normally, pthread mutex lock and unlock, if you use the mutex wrong, who knows what happens? But you can tell set a flag on the mutex to say, hey, I'd like you to tell me if I used the mutex wrong. So for example, if you lock the mutex twice in the same thread, normally, who knows what happens? If you set this flag, pthread mutex lock will return an error saying, hey, you goofed. Or normally, if you unlock a mutex that's already unlocked, who knows what will happen? Maybe it will do nothing. Maybe it will hang. If you set this flag, pthread mutex unlock will return an error. So this is a possible debugging tool. Another thing is that mutexes can be shared between processes. That's a feature you can enable. Now, there's a question we're going to answer in several weeks, which is, wait, mutexes are like a thing in memory. How can two processes have the same thing in memory? We learned about fork, and fork copied the memory. It's separate values. So we're going to have a way around that that we'll see in probably after spring break. Yeah?
Is there like a lock option where you can just try to lock, and if you can't get the lock, you just skip it?
The question, is there a lock option where you can just try to lock and just return, you know, failure if you can't get it right away? Yes, there's a function called pthread mutex try lock. I don't talk about it because I have almost never seen someone use it in a way on a homework which is helpful. But we'll probably mention it when we talk about deadlock. Other questions? So another thing about pthread mutexes is that there's a rule in pthread mutexes, a correctness rule, that you must always unlock the mutex from the same thread you locked it in. And I'm mentioning this because if you look over here, you might say, oh, wait, unlock mutex doesn't care where I unlock it from. So I can lock a mutex in one thread and unlock it in the other to like send a signal between different threads. You know, and you might think, oh, I can use this to like have one thread wait for another. And that's a great idea. But unfortunately, pthread mutexes just prohibit that by rule. And the reason why is that pthreads might not use an implementation quite like the one we saw. For example, maybe instead of storing lock taken, they store the ID of the thread that has the lock. Or something like that. So this is just not allowed because POSIX wanted to allow implementations which break this. Okay, so that's what I have to say about mutexes for now. Now we're going to go on to back to more general synchronization constructs. And I'm going to have an example that we're going to use a lot of times, which is the producer-consumer pattern. And this is something we'll want to do with multiple threads that both comes up a lot in practice, and also a lot of things which maybe don't look like this pattern, you can turn into it, and that's going to be helpful because we're going to have code samples of how to solve this problem, and our book has code samples, so you can just use the pattern and not have to like worry about all the details. And the idea here is we have a buffer that's going to be shared between multiple threads. And some threads are what we'll call producers, which are adding things to the buffer. And some threads are what we'll call consumers, which are removing things from the buffer. And the producers and consumers don't work in lockstep. So for example, maybe the producer ends up producing values faster than we can consume them, or the consumer ends up consuming values faster than we can produce them. And this creates a synchronization problem that locks aren't a good fit for. That if the producer is producing values too fast, you want to say, the buffer's full, stop. If the consumer is consuming values too fast, we want to say, the buffer's empty, wait. And this sort of waiting is what we're going to talk about how we implement. And in this picture, it looks like I have one producer and one consumer, but we're going to solve this where we could have multiple things producing and or multiple things producing, consuming, and not just one. And we'll just have to keep that in sync. And as I said, this comes up in a lot of cases which aren't obviously this sort of pattern. So one example is a C compiler. So C compiler has several steps. So we have a preprocessor, which produces data for a compiler, which produces data for the assembler, which produces stuff for the linker. And we can think of this as a producer-consumer problem because the preprocessor produces output that the compiler wants to process, which produces output the assembler wants to process, and so on. And if we have multiple cores, one way we can take advantage of multiple cores is by running the preprocessor and have it start producing output as the compiler is working on a separate core. And of course, the preprocessor is probably going to be like faster than the compiler. So we'll have to make sure that the preprocessor doesn't get too far ahead of the compiler or will run out of space to store its, what it's working on. So questions about this producer-consumer pattern, because I'm going to use it a lot of times. Don't want people to get too confused. Okay. So we're going to look at one very general synchronization construct and apply this to the producer-consumer pattern. And this is monitors or condition variables. So a monitor is going to be something composed of a bunch of components, some of which we've seen. So one of them is going to be locks, like mutexes we've seen before. Another is going to be this thing called a condition variable. And you'd think from the name condition variable that it like represents something which is true or false. And that's a nice assumption, and it's wrong. Condition variable kind of represents a list of waiting threads. You might say, there's a lot better names I could think of for that. I agree, but that's not the history we have. They're just called condition variables everywhere you're going to read them. And we're going to have some related data structures. And sort of the initial implementation of this idea of, called a monitor grouped these things together in an object, like in an object-oriented language. In fact, Java like really bought into this. So in Java, every object's a monitor because every object has its fields. So that's the related data structures. And it has a built-in lock and a built-in condition variable. Whether you ask for it or not, it's there. Now, we're going to be using pthreads. And pthreads doesn't have objects because it's for C, not C++. And it's build your own. So pthreads gives you the locks. It gives you the condition variables. You can put the shared data wherever you want. And you're just constructing this yourself rather than having some actual object the language provides. But the idea is that these things together are going to form what we'll call a monitor. So here's like what our monitor looks like. So we have a lock. And the lock, we're going to say, we're going to have a rule that we always acquire the lock before we touch any of the monitor stuff. We don't do anything without the lock. And that means that we have this one at a time actually manipulating the shared data or manipulating the condition variables. We don't have to worry about multiple threads doing that at once. They'll take turns. And we're going to have a lock that's implemented like with a mutex, so there's going to be some list of threads that are waiting for the lock. Okay, so we have a bunch of threads waiting for the lock. And while we're manipulating the values, we're going to do that, and then we're going to go to the next thread that's waiting for the lock. That's the normal way locks work. But where we're going to go beyond just what locks do is that we want threads that can be waiting for other things, where we don't want to run them when we unlock right away. We want to wait until something else happens. And since we want to wait for something else to happen, we want a separate list for the threads which are waiting for that something else. You might say, what's the something else? What might that be? So let's think of our producer-consumer example. The producers need to wait for the buffer to have space. The consumers need to wait for the buffer to have data. So those are things we might be waiting for. And we're waiting on a separate list because while the buffer doesn't have space, we don't want the lock. We can't use the buffer. We want to know when that happens. And we want some other thread to say, oh, the buffer has space now. Now you can run. And what other thread can do that? Well, the thread that, you know, frees something up from the buffer or adds something to the buffer is going to be the one that makes that call. So our condition variable is going to represent this list of threads that are waiting for something to become true, like the buffer having space. And the condition variable is going to have three operations. So there's going to be a wait operation. And notice that my wait operation here takes the condition variable and the lock, because it does something with both. So the condition variable is going to, the wait operation's going to unlock the lock and add the current thread to a condition variable's queue. So notice that we're both unlocking the lock and adding it, because the assumption is we never touch condition variables without the lock first, never touch anything in the monitor without the lock. And because we're unlocking the lock, that means part of waiting is, in addition to adding ourselves to a queue, we're going to let the next thing waiting for the lock go. And that's important because presumably we need to have other things use the shared data for us to stop waiting. You know, if we're waiting for the buffer to become not full, then something needs to take something off the buffer. We better run it. And we're also going to reacquire the lock before we return. So when eventually something decides that we should stop waiting, we're going to get the lock back right before we keep going. So you can think of the wait operation is add ourselves to this wait queue and give up the lock as long as we're waiting, but then get it right back. We want to give it the lock while we're waiting, because if we don't, nothing else can like actually change the thing we're waiting on. So then we have operations that remove things that are waiting for something to become true. So the simplest one is broadcast. So broadcast just says all the things that are waiting on the condition variable, they're done waiting on that. And conceptually, what you can think of that doing is that instead of waiting on the condition variable, now they're waiting for the lock. They'll get to run as soon as the lock is free again. So we can think that, you know, if now there's space in the buffer, we say, okay, all the threads that were waiting for space in the buffer, we add them to the list of things that should run when the buffer's next available. There's also a signal operation, because one thing you might observe is that, you know, sometimes we don't want to run all the things that are waiting, but we only want to run one. And this happens with the producer-consumer example. If I put one thing in the buffer, then probably only one thread can consume a value, not two. So the signal operation just chooses one thread. I'm not going to say which one it chooses. It just chooses one of them by some rule, and that rule is going to vary depending on what implementation of condition variables you have. Okay. So questions about these operations? Okay, so let's look at using condition variables. And I'm going to start with the simplest way I can think of using condition variables, which is we're going to have a thread that finishes something. And when it finishes something, it calls this finish function. And we're going to have a way to wait for the thread to finish, which is this wait for finish function. And here's our monitor. We have a lock. We have some shared data, which is this flag. Are we finished yet? And we have a condition variable that says these are the things waiting for us to finish. And we follow our rule that we never touch anything that's part of the monitor without acquiring the lock first. So that's why that's the first thing we do in both cases. And when we're waiting, the first thing we do is we check, did the thread already finish yet? We do that because we don't know whether or not wait for finish is called before or after the we finish. We don't have any way of proving that. So we just double check, did it already finish? If it did, then we don't need to do anything. If it didn't, then we wait. Now, you'll see that we have a while here. I'll explain why we have a while instead of an if in a bit. But it is, in fact, not a typo and very mandatory. So if we need to wait, we call the wait function, and this releases the lock. So if the thread calling finish is running at the same time, it's going to be held behind us until we start waiting. So we don't have to worry about it finishing as we start waiting. You know, it's either going to finish just before or just after in a way where we won't be confused about whether it finished. Because this wait operation releases the lock, you know, and will return when eventually we get broadcasted on the condition variable, and we return and double check that, yes, we actually finished, and return from wait for finished, like we expect. On the side of the finish function, we get the lock, we set the finish flag to true. We need to set that flag because otherwise, if wait for finish is called later, it will get confused and think it needs to still wait. We don't want that to happen. And we also broadcast to say, everyone who started waiting already, you're done. So questions about what I'm doing in this code beyond, except for the while versus if issue. So to give an example of what this looks like, you know, if wait for finish and finish are called at almost the same time. So let's say wait for finish in this case is called just before finish is called. So it gets the lock, and maybe finish gets called while it has the lock, but that's okay. Finish is going to wait for it to be done doing what it does with the lock, which is check, yes, it's not finished, I need to start waiting. And because we waited for it to start waiting, we're not going to have a problem of not signaling it that, yes, we really finished, even, you know, which we might have if we didn't have the lock, because it could check, oh, you haven't finished, I need to start waiting, without it being the case that we actually signal broadcasted after it started waiting. So we've ensured that after it started waiting, we broadcasted it. Eventually gets the lock back, double checks, oh, we're actually finished, and returns. Okay, so questions about what goes on here? And we also have, you know, the simple case I mentioned where the finished thread happens first, in which case we won't even wait. So I'm going to address the issue of why did we have a while loop? Why did we need to double check, you know, that, yes, it really finished. Of course it really finished. We woke up, we got finished the wait, we got broadcasted to. And, you know, it seems like that shouldn't be necessary. If wait returns, it seems like it ought to be the case. That's because finish was called and called pthreadcon broadcast to make the wait return. And sure seems like it would be true, but if we read the pthread manual page, there's this very annoying sentence, spurious wakeups may occur. And a spurious wakeup means wait returns for no good reason. And you might say, why the heck did POSIX put that in there? That seems horribly useless. And basically the answer is that allowing wait to be implemented in a sloppy way where they do this sort of approximation of do I need to wake up that sometimes says you need to wake up when you don't makes things faster. And they decided making things faster was worthwhile, even though this makes everyone else's life harder because they have to double check, did I really wake up for the right reason? It also turns out that for other reasons I'll show you on the next slide, that it's actually very hard to avoid double checking that we were really supposed to wake up because of a different issue that occurs in most cases we use condition variables. It doesn't occur in the case I just showed you, but in something like a producer-consumer example, it's actually very hard to avoid double checking and have correct code because of other threads that might be doing things in the meanwhile. Some questions about spurious wakeups. Okay, so let's look at implementing producer-consumer now that we know how condition variables work and about this spurious wakeups problem. And I'm going to start with a simple case for producer consumer, which is an unbounded buffer. So I'm going to say my consume thread, it's going to take an item from the buffer, but it's going to wait if the buffer is empty. But my produce thread's just going to make the buffer bigger as much as it needs to. So here's my code. The produce method takes an item, adds it to the buffer. The consume method removes an item from the buffer and returns it. So notice that following my pattern for monitors, I always lock while I'm doing anything with the monitor. And this buffer is conceptually part of the monitor, as is my condition variable I've called data ready. And I have a case in consume where I need to wait while the buffer is empty. As long as the buffer is empty, I can't actually dequeue a value, so I wait. And something to note is that because we have this lock, I know that when pthreadconwait returns, that the lock is held, and I check whether the buffer is empty with the lock, and I don't release the lock between when I check whether it's empty and when I dequeue. So I know that there's no possibility some other thread calls consume in between and makes it so I thought it was empty, but it became empty before I got the value off it. And that's why it's really important that we have this lock, because otherwise we check it's empty, dequeue, and we might get unlucky. But it's not possible because of the lock, no other thread can sneak in there. Now, when the buffer's empty, we call this conwait. That's going to start waiting. And there's this corresponding signal in the produce to wake up one consume thread. We use signal because we know I enqueued one value. Only one call to consume is going to be able to use that. If there's multiple calls to consume right now, you know, I could broadcast, but only one of them would find the buffers actually empty. And you might say, shouldn't we check if someone's waiting? Well, we could do that, but it's not necessary because, you know, if none are waiting, then pthreadconsignal is just going to do nothing, and that's fine. So questions about this code? Yeah?
Just to be clear, when you call wait, when that's called, you release the lock.
Question is, when we call wait, we release the lock, and once we return to get the lock back, yes. So we need to release the lock because otherwise the produce, if there's someone calling produce, they won't get to run. But we need the lock back because otherwise we can't know that when we check the buffer's empty, it's going to stay empty or stay not empty. Okay, other questions? Okay, so we have this loop here. So this loop can execute pretty much any number of times. Now, some of them are obvious. So how can this loop, this while buffer is empty loop, execute any zero times? How can we have zero iterations of that loop? Yeah, so if the buffer is just always has stuff on it, then that loop is going to execute zero iterations. And one iteration is probably the most obvious case. That's the buffer is empty when we call consume, and then produce adds one thing to it. But that loop can also execute two or more times, and it can execute two or more times even without spurious wakeups. And that's not intuitive at all. So zero times, we understand. Oh, we added something earlier, and it's still there. And one time, we understand. Oh, it was empty. Then we waited for a while, and a produce call ran and added something. But it's actually possible for it to be called two or more times. And this is because there's something you might not like about how signal and broadcast tend to work. And something which is not true in all types of monitors, but is true in POSIX monitors and most versions of condition variables you'll see in practice. And this is going to require a third thread. So there's something a third thread is going to do. I'm going to show you that scenario here, because it's not at all obvious. So we're going to start the same way when we had one iteration, that we're going to call consume, we're going to get the lock, we're going to say, yes, it's empty, and we're going to start waiting. And we're waiting on the condition variable. OK, no problem. Then the produce comes along, it gets the lock, because we don't have it. It enqueues a value, it signals, that wakes us up. Great, it stops us waiting, and we just need to get the lock now. Remember, after we stopped waiting on the condition variable, now we're waiting on the lock. Okay. So we're waiting on the lock now. And the producer unlocks. And when we had the previous scenario, we just start running then. But here, there's this third thread, and it gets the lock instead. It started waiting on the lock because it just started running consume and hadn't even checked if the buffer's empty yet. And it got the lock first. And you might say, why would this happen? Well, the problem here is that, you know, the signal woke up thread 2, but the unlock woke up thread 3, not thread 2. And you might legitimately say, that shouldn't happen. The unlock should know that we did this signal and should wake up thread 2 instead. And there are some versions of monitors which do this, but not any you're likely to encounter, and not the ones that pthreads has. So instead, the lock works independently. And in this example, you know, this is actually pretty realistic. The lock is just going to the first thing which was waiting on the lock. Thread 3 was the first thing waiting for the lock because thread 2 didn't wait until the signal happened. Right? And it's just that the signal and the lock aren't integrated enough. And the reason why you might implement it this way is, well, it's easier to not have your signal and lock be tightly coupled like that. But the end result is now this third thread gets to run in between, and it removes the thing that thread 2 was signaled for. So when thread 2 runs again, it says, still empty, and it needs to wait again. So questions about this scenario? Yeah?
Is it common for there to be a thread that consumes some resource that you don't expect it to consume and then you get stuck in an infinite loop like this? Or is this intentional?
So first the question is, is it common for it to be this third thread that consumes something? So the way this would happen is that we have probably just have two consuming threads. So, you know, like if it's the compiler example, I have two cores running assemblers. And whichever one gets to it first assembles the current file. Does that make sense? As for the infinite loop, thread two is not going to be in an infinite loop, assuming eventually someone else produces. Probably thread two will get to run and actually stop waiting anymore. Does that answer your questions? Okay. So I mentioned that the problem here is that the signal stopped the production thread from waiting, but made it start waiting on the lock, and that didn't guarantee that it got the lock next. And there are two styles of monitors. So there's something called Hoare-style monitors, where signal hands off the lock to the thread that's woken up. So where that scenario I just showed you isn't possible, because part of waking up the thread is ensuring it gets the lock next. And there's Mesa-style monitor, where any eligible thread, any thread waiting on the lock right now, can get the lock next. And it's a completely independent decision that ignores everything which happened with signals and broadcast, except that, of course, things that were signaled could get the lock now. But they don't have any special preference necessarily. And every threading library I'm aware of, in particular pthreads, definitely like the threading library that comes with the C++ standard library and so on, use Mesa style. And you're not likely to encounter Core style, though they do exist. Yes?
In a Core style, would that mean that if you broadcast to all the sleeping threads, it would just go in the already existing order?
Question is, in Core style, if you broadcast, does it go in the existing order? I don't know. I would assume so, but I don't know. Other questions? Okay, so I've shown you our unbounded buffer producer-consumer, and I'm going to turn this into a bounded buffer producer-consumer, so the full version of the problem. And something I like about condition variables and monitors is that they're well-suited to this sort of incrementally building up our synchronization. So I can start with the unbounded version, and you'll see that I'll just add a little bit of extra code to my unbounded version to do it. I don't have to like plan from scratch. So here's my bounded example, and I've highlighted the code I've added. So I added a new condition variable because I have a new reason to wait. You know, I was already waiting for there to be something to consume. Now I need to wait for there to be space to put something. So I have a new condition variable for that. And I know that the produce needs to wait for space, so I do the same kind of thing I did in consume in produce, but with the other condition variable and checking if the buffer is full rather than if it's empty. And I know when I consume a value, I free up one bit of space, so I have a signal at the end of consume to wake up at most one producer that's waiting. Sometimes there will be none. That's fine. The signal just does nothing. Some questions about this code I added here. So another thing I like about monitors that's arguably nice and arguably not is that I could be sloppy and still have the correct result happen, but just have things be slower. So for example, if I used broadcast instead of signal here, things would work correctly. I just have more quote, things that look like spurious wake-ups. Like, I should use signal. That's going to be faster and more efficient. But if I can't think of, do I need to signal here? I can just broadcast, and at least I won't get the wrong results. I won't have things hanging. You know, at least it's going to give me the great answer. Also, if I decided to only have one condition variable, I could replace both of these condition variables with a single ready variable and always broadcast instead of signaling, and I still get the right answer. So I could be sloppy in that way. I could say, you know, I don't know exactly who I need to wake up. I'll just broadcast whenever I know someone might have needed to wake up and have them figure it out with their while loop. Because they're going to have a while loop double checking the condition. So if I'm not sure if I need to wake someone up, I can just wake everyone up. Now, you probably shouldn't do this, but this is an option, so like we have this sloppiness that it allows that something like semaphores, we're probably going to have to be a little more careful. Is this good? Hard to say, because yeah, you don't want to actually use a lot of extra time double-checking things that aren't true, but it's an option, and that we can do this is probably why Java felt it was fine to have every object have a built-in single condition variable, because it's enough. It's not great, but it's enough to do what you want, just inefficiently. So that's why Java 1.0 decided to build that in. Of course, Java has access to separate condition variables, too, that are more flexible. Okay. So questions about our producer-consumer code here. So when you use signal versus broadcast, so signal says choose exactly one thread. So assuming this buffer's capacity is based on the number of items, then when I dequeue one item, at most one thread can go. Now, let's say the buffer's capacity was based on something like bytes, and items had different sizes. Then when I dequeue one item, that might mean 1, 2, 3, 4, or something, a known number of things could go. In that case, I might want to broadcast. Or when we saw my finished example, if two threads called wait for finish, I want both of them to go, so I call broadcast. Yeah.
What's the difference between data ready and space ready?
So the question is, what's the difference between data ready and space ready? So these are separate lists of waiting threads. And in this code, we follow the convention that threads which are waiting for data to be in the buffer wait on data ready. Threads which are waiting for the buffer to have space wait on space ready. And because we follow that convention, these are independent. And I know, for example, when I signal space ready, I'm not going to wake up someone calling consume. And that's good because, you know, if I wake up someone calling consume instead of someone calling produce, then the thread calling produce might never get woken up. Does that answer your question? So an important thing is that we match up the condition we're waiting for and the condition variable signaling. And our general pattern with monitors is that we require a lock, we wait for the status of the shared data, whatever it is, to be ready. And for each sort of thing we wait for, we'll have a condition variable. So here I have a condition variable for this condition A. I wait for condition A to become true on using that condition variable and double checking each time I get broadcast in case something changes in the meanwhile, like some thread sneaks in and undoes the condition being true, like we saw with that someone taking the item out of the buffer in between us getting signal and running. Then I do whatever I need to do, like adding to a buffer, and I figure out, did I change any conditions any of the other threads care about? And if so, I broadcast on that condition variable, or if I know only one thread cares, like I know I added one item to a buffer, only one thread's going to be able to use that buffer, maybe I can signal. So, questions about this pattern. So, for using monitors, rules of thumb. So, I've emphasized we have this shared data. You never touch it without using a lock. There's no exceptions. You always use the lock. Yeah. If you don't need to use the lock, the question is it really something that's related to the conditions or the monitor, but we always take turns accessing the data, and we hold it for the entire operation. So for example, if we're checking if the buffer is not full, we have to keep the lock held until we actually, you know, take advantage of the buffer not being full. If we don't do that, maybe the buffer becomes full in the meanwhile. And for everything we want to wait for, we have a separate condition variable, and we always have a loop for waiting on the condition variable, where we always double check, you know, I stop waiting, but can I really stop waiting? Or do I need to go back to waiting again? And I broadcast or signal if I know only one thread cares every time I change one of those conditions. So I have to figure out, does this change or possibly change one of those conditions? If so, broadcast or signal. And if you aren't sure whether you have to broadcast or signal, broadcasting at least won't give you the wrong answer, but it might be very inefficient in some cases. You know. And if you aren't sure whether you really changed something, then broadcasting or signal will at least, you know, not break anything because threads are always double checking, and so on. But obviously it's better, and you should prefer to not like have to take advantage of these rules, but you have that flexibility if you want to be sloppy. So questions, this. And as a final little note, so pthreads has condition variables. I haven't shown you the corresponding functions, though you could have probably guessed them from what you saw with mutexes and barriers. So there's an init, or an alternate way of initializing, and a destroy, and we saw the wait and broadcast and so on. That's where I'll leave off today.